Somewhere Sri Aurobindo says that, I think in the Life Divine, first chapter even, that to go to these inner experiences, one needs language. And it seems that there is only one language in which these experiences of inner life were systematically presented and understood. And it was only Sanskrit language. All other languages are dealing with reality differently, in more natural or naturalistic way, if you like. That's why there was a division on Prakrit and Sanskrit languages. Prakrit languages are more natural languages, where the drive to live is dominating the language. So whatever is there appearing in conversational language is fixed by its use. That's why Patanjali says you have to go to the marketplace to learn about the use of the words, because it is fixed in a natural sense. And today I was thinking about this strange phenomenon of creating words and fixing their use. And you can see this happening in English language all the time. New words are coming in. Not very nice words, by the way, which are fixed strongly in the language. The same happens in the Russian language. Usually these lower kinds of words are fixed in usage for a while, and then they disappear. And if you take a language of 50 years back, you will find that curses were different. And imagery was completely different 100 years back. I speak about Russian language, but if you take any other English the same way, you will find that there was no such even concept, you know. These concepts are coming from lower perception and they are fixed in the language. This is Prakrit. In Sanskrit this would not take place, because the language has its own level somewhere and deals with realities which are of different kind. It is not meant to project or to reflect something of the natural reality. It is meant to project the consciousness on the level of which it is stabilized, to introduce or to intrude even into the natural reality. So there is a division between artificial, so to say, artificial from materialistic scientific point of view language. That's why my teacher in the university said that Sanskrit language is artificial language. It has nothing to do with reality. This reality, you know this reality? Yes, it has nothing to do with this reality. It has something to do with a higher reality and projects its influence on this lower reality. It has its purpose, its meaning, and its... That's why Sanskrit language didn't change over the period of 6,000 years. And many people wondered, how come? You see, languages are changing. In 100 years you cannot recognize English anymore, or Russian. If you read Dostoevsky now, you can't read him. Your breath is breaking, because the manner how he was writing, the manner how he was thinking, is no more applicable to this Russian man. There is another Russian man already, another language. So what to say about 6,000 years? And several paradigms of... Yes, there are.
And is it changing there?
Yes, they change it as they can. But language stays the same. What is that property of language which does not permit drastic change? Yeah? It changes and it comes back. There was one academician, Toporov, who was describing this phenomenon of Sanskrit creating other languages, other systems of thought, and coming back as if to itself. was as breathing out and breathing in, never allowing that foundation to disappear, that pure foundation. It's a puzzle. How come for so many thousands of years, not just one or two, the language is fixed? What is that unchangeable stuff of this language which we do not see? I'm starting from this faraway prelude because I want to move into a very strange topic and most difficult topic today, but most exciting in the sense that I want to look into the poetics and how poetic word was organized. We already looked into basic structure of language, Sporter theory, how syntax is organized, how it was seen, how verb and noun were treated. I just give you a glimpse. I cannot go into grammar more because people are not in the Sanskrit field, so it's impossible to really prolong that thing into more detail. If you have some questions or interest to go there, we can go. I would go with pleasure into that. But I see that people are split. Those who are not interested and cannot follow grammatical categories, and those who are interested in those categories because they study language. So this language was organized in such a manner that it could stay over the period of several millennia unchanged.
Yes, it was spoken by the simple people,
yes. And these were Prakrits. By the way, the whole system of Prakrits, which is presented in dramas, we know about them only from dramas, Kalidasa and Bhasa, every writer was using different Prakrits for different characters. They were cognized by their language. It's like today, you can recognize where people are coming from, what background, what city, and so on and so forth. So it was very interesting to see how they were. So from dramas we can learn about history and the history of language especially. Oh, for example, I was mentioning already, the king was speaking in Sanskrit, but the queen had to answer to him in Prakrit. She was not answering in Sanskrit. It's in post-Vedic, in medieval period, yes? There was a shift. For example, women were not allowed to speak Sanskrit, only Devadasis, only those dancers in the temples, they were speaking Sanskrit because the language of their tuition was Sanskrit. So the Brahmins were teaching them how to dance. Actually, a man was a teacher of women, how to become a woman. And you can see this man, sometimes they are coming from these Odissi, our gurus, so to say, 26 or 30 years old guru. And when he was dancing a woman on the stage, you remember here? It was a woman. It was the best woman you can see. So he learned about all those moods, and so he teaches women to be a woman. Can you imagine that? Not women were teaching women to dance. So these were Brahmins, the highest caste, that's why they were speaking Sanskrit, and Devadasis picked up that language in the medieval period. Before it was different. Of course, Brahmins, the wives of Brahmanas, were speaking Sanskrit, not Prakrit. Yes. So, before it was absolutely different. In the time of Patanjali, when he says you go to the marketplace, Sanskrit was spoken in the marketplace by everyone. Whoever was there, it didn't matter. So there was a time when Sanskrit was spoken, long ago, BC, 200 BC, it's the last mentioning of this kind of event. After that, there was a shift. Sanskrit became a language of a Brahmana caste, mainly. Now, today I wanted to look into this issue of Vedic prosodics, prosodi, poetics. I will start with Vedic because it seems that what is this poetic word? I think it is because of this poetic word Sanskrit was preserved over millennia. It's not because of its spoken marketplace language, but because of this word which was fixed in the poetic form. So what do you think poetry is? What is this rhythmic word? Have you thought about this? These would be only examples of different meters in the Veda. I will give the examples and then maybe read to you different things. One more. Oh, sorry. I will try to make it better. Where is this full page? Oh. Better? Maybe it's a most difficult question to define. What is poetry? What is poetic word? Right.
I should say poetry in any language should have rhythm and color and at least a veiled meaning.
This is nice.
It must be able to understand something in your imagination.
All right. So meaning is the last thing to be mentioned. By the way, it should have some meaning, otherwise, you know. Some poetry doesn't have meaning. You mean direct meaning? Yeah, that's
no, I mean,
pragmatic meaning.
By connotation.
Yeah, well, right.
Implied meaning.
Implied. Applied, not applied, but implied, right. Okay, good definition. There has to be a rhythm. This rhythm in the Vedic prosody is called chandas, and there is the whole literature dedicated to the studies of different rhythms. So there has to be a particular rhythm. It's like we are speaking, we are breathing in and breathing out. It's a rhythm, it's a circle, breathing in and breathing out. Now the poetry has to have the same. There is an opening, a peak, and breathing out, closing. This opening and closing is pada, yes? What is called a verse, a meter, a rhythm. Now words are fitting into certain rhythms and into certain they don't fit. So the Sanskrit language chooses several possibilities of that to fit their words in a natural flow into these rhythms. And these rhythms were of three or four kinds in the Rig Veda. Five-syllabic pada, eight-syllabic pada, 11-syllabic pada, and 12-syllabic pada. Pada can be translated as a foot, but it's not very true translation. It's rather a combination of several feet into one bigger unit, which is a verse rather than a foot. A line, yes. A line is better. So five-syllabic pada is, as you see here,
is very rarely used by the way, is viraj. I don't want even to stay on it because you hardly find anything on this five. It's an exception to the rule. We will, maybe if you want, we will look at it. It's the most difficult pada to read. But if you want, we can come to it back to complete the whole. But eight syllabic meter is...
Excuse me, I just would say one thing about this, because I picked upon this in the last 10 days in my translation work. And then what struck me, it was in the first book and then in the tenth book, there was always a particular style of expression in the hymn. There was a certain intensity of putting one thing after another, just image after image. That was interesting, so I was immediately right in my book, the tenth book, so the Rishi had the same style of content and style of poetry. And then he chose the same word, and this struck me.
Yes.
No,
yes, it's a very active way of speaking, so to say, which is always open. Five syllabic pada, you can imagine. There is no even distribution of the word. You can see Pashva Natayum Guha Chatantam Namo Yujantam Namo Vahantam. This kind of hammering rhythm, yes, which is establishing some kind of open power which is hitting you all the time, every line. It's not even, it's not distributing words, not embracing. It cannot be a way to use this rhythm or this meter for epics, for example. It's too active, too strong for the epic line to embrace bigger portion of text. That's why for the epic line we have eight syllabic pada. And our Anushtubh, by which all Mahabharata and Ramayana is written, is in this pada. Eight syllabic, it's already even. And it is ta 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 ta, ta 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 ta. Yes. Ta 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 ta, ta 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 ta, ta 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 ta. Ta 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 ta. This is Anushtubh. You can feel its quantity and quality is held within itself. It does not require any addition. It doesn't hit you. It's not ta 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 ta. So,
I'm wondering if there's a certain, perhaps at a great distance, a certain parallel to the five meter in rhythm in music. When you have folk dances from some countries, you often have in a fire rhythm, which is not customary in the Western parts of Europe. You know, and it seems. Since I was also a young folk dancer, it seems that the step with it, when you have this fire rhythm, it's at the last beat of the measure, you expect it to go on. And then there's a push, there's an intensity, it goes right to the next emphasis. Like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's the suspension.
Like a circular suspense in it somehow. I don't know, maybe that's too far-fetched.
No, it might make sense. You know, dancing steps. In different folk dance, they have different characters. It's very true. It's very interesting. I never thought about it. It's for the first time I hear this comparison.
Macedonia, for example, goes from 13/16 to 5/4 to 3/4 time and then back. And feet are falling to speed all the time.
So they're very rajasic in a way.
Awesome. Well,
yes. So when these eight syllabic padas, they are usually iambic, as you can see. Ta 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 ta. What is iambic is that the second syllable is stressed. Yes. First is bears no accent, so it appears like a step. Ta ta. Ta ta.
to ta, to ta. This is one, so to say, portion of this line, to ta, or 1 foot, we can say, with 2 iambic steps, to ta, to ta, to ta, to ta. It's like that. Agnim ire purohitam. There is a mistake, so strange. Agnim ire purohitam yajnyasya devam ritvijam hotaram vipindhatanam. So when combined in 3 meters, so to say, gives Gayatri. Agnim ire purohitam yajnyasya devam ritvijam hotaram ratnadhatanam. Tatsavitur varenyam bhargo devasya dhimahi dhiyo yonav prachodayat. Iambic Gayatri rhythm with 3 8-syllabic padas. When combined in 4, it gives us tetrameter, or it builds anushtup. Anushtup is that what we know as rhythm by which the whole epic is written, Ramayana and Mahabharata, yes? And Puranas all. So it's the most beautiful, the most easy going rhythm. Dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsavah. So I'm reading to you in iambic rhythm, that's why it sounds so strange, yes? It should be dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsavah mama kav pandavaschaiva kimakurvata sanjaya. But if you read in iambic, dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsavah mama kav pandavaschaye kimakurvata sanjaya. So you can change the flow of the rhythm. And what is interesting here, though this rhythm has no caesura, no cadenza, it still has an opening and closing, breathing in and breathing out, yes? Agni mile purohitam. It is a closing. Because pada cannot stay separately as such if there was no opening and closing. So you can see 4 belong to the opening and 4 belong to the closing. And it's quite interesting because from this I analyzed the first sloka of the Gita and it gave me an insight, you know. If you look at this, dharma kshetre is an opening in the field of dharma, and the closing is kuru kshetre, is an echoing, is an, as if an answer. Dharma kshetre in the field of dharma, kuru kshetre in the field of kuru, answer. Samaveta came together, yuyutsavah, the echo, those who want to fight. Now, you see, it's like as if contradicting to the opening. Opening is breathing in something, and closing is breathing out something else. And this is the beauty of the poetry, which is going through without us thinking about it, without us noticing it. It has a meaning which is inherent in the rhythm. Why the poet put that word there and not in other place? And that's how he manipulates some subtle meaning or perception. When I started to speak about this in this, in the Chanda section, in the conference on the Rig Veda, Nishtha was there, he saw what happened. There were guys who jumped on me. He said, "No!" We couldn't stop the guy. He was so furious. He was ready to kill me there on the spot. No, the reason is that I am violating something which he already knows. That was the reason. But I wanted to bring some other perception into poetry because they are taking it too formally. And in the Indian chandas, they do not have this knowledge of poetry as it is known in the Greek prosodics. Because in the Greek, they studied it differently. And they see cadenzas, openings, closings. They do not have this in chandas. So what I did something illegitimate. I took it from Greek poetry and brought it into Sanskrit. And they cannot stand it. And he is right from his point of view. But I wanted to widen the perception and to see maybe something else. Actually, I wanted to bring the spoken, the poetry of the Rig Veda to the reader, that he could read it now, as we read in our class. But I didn't have a chance. After that, I didn't want to try again. Though I was presiding over that particular session, I could have my word, but they didn't want me to even open my mouth. So when these 8 syllabic padas are combined in 4, we have this Anushtubh meter by which the whole epic is written. Then when we combine them in 5, we have Pankti meter, that means 2 and 3. Again, you see, there will be a division. 2, then breath, you have to take your breath, yeah, and then 3, and then to take your breath. The same with Gayatri. If you notice, there will be a split after 2, yes? Agni mile purohitam, agni mile purohitam yajnasya devam ritvijam hotaram ratnadhatavam. So there will be a bigger opening and closing in the whole 3, yes? Tatsavitur vareniyam bhargo devasya dhimahi dhiyoyo nav prachodayat. So the breath is to be taken after 2 and then 1. Now we have 2 and 2, 2 and 3. And then when we add one more, Mahapankti 2 and 4. And then Shakvari 3 and 4. And it's important for the rhythm. If we are not following it, we would not have a verse, a poetry.
And then what happens when they chant? Nothing of this will come out.
No, it is not coming out. Yeah, this is the analysis from the Greek poetry point of view, by the way. It's that what they do in the West. That's where I know it from. I know it from our tradition of our Indology. And I was surprised that when I looked into Chandas, these things were not available. Because of this particular Vedic reading, yes, of Svarita, Anudatta, Anudatta. Now, 11 syllables pada is very interesting. Syllabic pada is Trishtup, and 2/5 of all hymns in the Rig Veda are written in this rhythm. It's a very popular rhythm. It is also there in Puranas, epic Ramayana, Mahabharata. You can hear it once in a while when they are tired of Anushtub, they shift to Trishtup. And Trishtup is that with which the whole 11, or half of it at least, 11th chapter of the Gita is written, where the Vishvarupa Darshana. So 11 syllabic pada is something very interesting. And here you have to make a pause in order to read rightly the verse. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Ta 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 ta. Yahva iva, Yahva iva, pravayam ud jihanah. Yahva iva, you have to make a pause. Yahva iva, pravayam ud jihanah. Abodhihota yajathaya devan yahvaiva pravayam ujjihan. Aha, it took difficult, unfortunately, here. I will give you some other which are easier.
I would like to know, if they count the quick huh at the end of a word as a syllable, or does that
Yeah, it counts. It can be long or short. These are the varieties when you see this is the long syllable, heavy, and this is short. Both are possible. It can be ta ta ta, ta ta ta, yeah? Ta 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 ta. I will read to you and now you will understand. It's quite a beautiful rhythm. Trishtup is the most beautiful, by the way. Abodhi agnih samidha jananam pratidhenu ivayatim ushasam. I make a pause. Nobody makes pauses in Vedic reading. There are no pauses. They read abodhi agnih samidha jananam pratidhenum ivayatim ushasam yahva iva pravayam ujjihanav prabhanavav sisratena kamachha. And they even speak about this, that we know what is the rhythm only at the end. We cannot hear it in the middle or at the beginning. But rhythm is heard immediately, yeah, if you read it properly. In this way, abodhi agnih samidha janana pratidhenum ivayatim ushasam yahvaiva pravayam ujjihanah prabhanavah sisrate nakam accha. Abodhi hota yajathaya devan urdvo agnih sumanav Pratar asthat samidhasya rushat adarshi pajo mahandevas tamaso niramochi. So this rhythm is so difficult to hold. Tata 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 tata. You can feel the power of Trishtup. It's a most beautiful rhythm, I think. More beautiful than Gayatri, than Anushtup, because it is not always iambic. It's also trochaic. In this ta 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 closing, yes? To ta to ta to 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 ta ta to ta to to ta to ta to 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 ta to. Tato, this tato, tato, it is open-ended and it hits and it has iambic opening and trochaic closing. So in this kind of Trishtup is built. Abodhi agnih samidha jananam prati dhenum ivayatim ushasam Yahvaiva pravayam ujjihanah prabhanavah sisrate nakam accha. So if you listen to this rhythm longer, it settles down in a very powerful way. So there are two ways of reading it. The opening with four, syllabic, iambic, with five. Then there is a pause, caesura. And then there is a shift, double shift. You can stop again and close it down. Or you can just follow without stopping. But where comma is, you must stop and make this pause of one syllable. Then the whole rhythm comes up. So there is...
Most of the compositions are really that the word stops. Most of them. It's not going into the middle of the word. They are, I noticed, most of
them I come
across, it's really, you feel it when you start the work, you know, the sentence,
yes.
And the phrase,
you know,
goes to the
caesura. Yes.
It's quite obvious.
We read in this rhythm our Savitar hymns, as you remember. There are many Jagatis here, but there are also Trishtups, and one of the Trishtups we will read would be of this next, from the 6th and 7th book, which I will read to you, just for you to feel. Trishtup. Udushya devah savitaya yama Hiranyayim amatim yam ashishret Nunam bhago Haviyo manushebhir Viyo ratna puruvasur dadhati Udutishtha, udutishtha fo Savitah Shruddhi Asya You hear, you see, Udu Tishtha Savita Shruddhi Asya Hiranyapane Prabhritao Ritasya Viurvim Prithvim Amatim Srejana Anribhyo Martabhojanam Suvana. And so.
Actually, I have a question. When you read like this, is that then more understandable for you when you know Sanskrit? Because I can't understand the word. So for me, just to note, like Mary said. When you make it in the other way, which would like it, you mostly know when somebody reads this nice Sanskrit tune.
You're very right, because if we read it right with this breath and this opening and closing, what is happening, we are following the mind of the Rishi. Now, I'm not adding to this difficulty the point that every word has its own accent, morphological accent, which has to be read properly, which adds to this difficulty to keep with the rhythm. But if that is maintained, what we have a pure expression of poetry, which is not only the rhythm, but also the word as it sounds in the language, and how it was chosen to be incorporated in this, into this flow. And these two elements of the accent in the word and the rhythm, with opening and closing, cadenza and caesura, when it is followed, the poetry finally appears. And believe me, to find that poetry is so difficult, nearly impossible, because nobody reads in this way. So what I did this for several years, trying to find this nishthanos. I was always changing, bringing another option of the rhythm. Now look to this. And I was reading according to chandas, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, all these things, you know. But?
Yeah, I mean, it's joking. Powerful when you can understand the words, and when you read that now in the old way, can you read the same?
What she wants to say, it's much nicer at the moment.
Yeah, not nicer, but it's full different.
Sure, sure. Of course, it has its beauty. Yeah, I agree with you. No, no, I am following Rishi's way.
So what is now right?
Wonder
what is wrong or what is before? I mean,
yes.
from the sense, what you understand.
No, I am not violating Rishi's way of poetry. This is one thing which I want to say. I'm trying to find it. Because the preservation of the text where Udatta was marked, yes? Agnimihile purohitam yajnasya devam ratvijam. What was done by this, it was fixed. Udatta was fixed. Udatta is morphological accent in the word. And chandas was fixed. But it is a way of recording it by the voice. Huh?
To memorize.
To not to lose the text. Mm-hmm. Now once the text was preserved, I don't think any rishi read his original poetry in this way. It's impossible to imagine this. It's just not that. The poetry is the word which is coming out of you, in which has a particular rhythm within itself, accent, morphological accent, and the rhythm of chandas determines its position. So, that's what happened. Now, text is preserved now, but it is read in the same preservational way. Yes? As if that is a poetry. It's not a poetry. It's a preservation of the text. Poetry has to be read in a poetic sense. It has opening, it has closing.
You used the word
read. It is read back from pages, but if they memorize it and not to lose the memory or make mistakes, there is handle movements and all this stuff. It is a technique of
very true, very true. And what is the point here is that if I will read to you how it has to be read, you will see that nobody can memorize this way of reading. It's impossible to memorize it in the way how poetry sounds. It's simply impossible. Because every word has different accent and interposition changes the chandas. Every line sounds different. You will not have access to it, you will not memorize it, it's a unique line. Every line is a unique line. So, in order to preserve the text, this device was seen that every time where morphological accent falls, udatta we call, the lower pitch is to be introduced in the previous syllable. It's a normal device, yes? We speak this way. In order to emphasize, I put two in the lower pitch. To make emphasis higher. That's what we do, we just don't register it. And once it is high, it falls natural, which is svarita. This was the device introduced into the preservation of the text. But the text itself, poetic, is something altogether different and has to be reconstructed.
Yeah,
chandas itself is available to us 200 AD. There is no chandas earlier than this in the Vedic studies. So we know that the whole idea of chandas appeared later, in medieval period already. We do not have that study. And if you see what chandas people say, you would be surprised. They will count syllables and they will say all those things which you don't want to know. It has nothing to do with poetry. It's not about poetry anymore. The poetry is here. It's actually we are taking from Greeks the format by which they were analyzing poetry. Yes, but doesn't matter. But they had their own poetics, where they analyzed the stanza, the paras, the meter, in such a way that they had this particular knowledge, which is now fully applicable. And if I apply this knowledge to Vedic reading, you will see that it is applicable, it is meaningful. So if it would be not meaningful, it would be visible.
It's not only that, I'm just maybe going to this topic too much, but what happened just to me when I started to chant the Veda, myself, and I just didn't care for this traditional way. I just took it and tried to chant it according to Veda, to meaning, but it naturally has fallen into the young immediately. You know, without thinking. Without even understanding
it, it's there. It's not to belittle the great Vedic tradition. Yes, it's not to say that it depends on Greeks. It's not for that I'm saying. I'm saying that Greeks had this knowledge about poetics, which was lost somehow, which was not relevant for the preservation of the text. We are taking it from there with understanding what pada or stanza means. And we know it by reading any other poetry. If you see it in any English, Latin, Russian poetry, you will have the same laws of opening and closing, breathing in and out, cadenzas and caesuras. You will have them. And if it is not fitting into Trishtupa, it would not fit, but it fits very well. It defines the rhythm. And this knowledge is not in chandas. That's what I'm saying.
Could you compare it with somebody reading poem in some other language, and some people would read it without the proper space of reading in, and others they would read in, like not really reading, but the space at the right time, at the right space. Because I was thinking when you read this just before, this long section, oh, I'm making these gestures. It almost scared me, you know. I don't understand a word of Sanskrit except a couple of Purvajans.
Scared.
And it seemed like the meaning, like you said, the meaning is there, but you can't grasp it. I mean, I wouldn't say it's understood, but it was something that made me feel, oh, that's incredibly meaningful.
Yes. because the rhythm and the word, they live and they are within your breath and within your reach. When you read this way, you become that poetry. It sounds within you as it was sounding within the Rishi. So it's another reading. And that meaning comes to you when you know Sanskrit, it comes natural. You understand what the subtlety of perception led him to this expression. It's very impossible, it's impossible to describe other than read. That's why poetic rhythm is so unique. It touches something deep within you, some deeper perception, because it becomes deeply subjective. It is as if you are a poet, and it is your poetry which you read. So this deep subjective perception involves you fully and explains to you things which you may not see otherwise in objective reading. So you try them out and you feel those energies and you feel those meanings are changing. They are not the same as you know them by the mind and dictionaries and reading other literature which is prosaic. It's another perception. You know it in poetry also. In poetry, we understand poetry only when it is our native language, truly speaking. Did you notice that? It's nearly impossible to understand poetry in another language. It's a very strange thing because it's very intimate and very subjective. If I read to you Russian poetry, I will be in tears and you will think, what an idiot, because that abracadabra doesn't mean anything to you. No? Yeah, I meant something deeper than that. I agree with you. I agree with your disagreement. Yes, rhythm will be there, and the beauty of the sound will be there. Everything will be as if there, but the depth of intimacy, of relation to that particular word, which is taken from other context and put into this poetic rhythm, will not be there. Yes, because the word which you lived from your childhood, which became kind of part of your identity, is used differently now. And that difference is very essential for the poetry. Yes, one can learn everything, by the way. Yes. We can feel it, but...
Well, in German, there were words that I knew their meaning, and I'd never even heard them in English. There wasn't an equivalent in English. I knew them.
Yes, we can learn it, but we cannot feel them the same way as native speaker feels. I know it only because when I read Russian poetry to myself, I say, what a thing. How come that it hits me so deep? And when I read English poetry, even the best, yes? It's very nice. I will not cry, by the way. It's very deep. But it is not the same. You will laugh at it. What? Yeah. That is a poetry. There was a girl in Russia who died, who committed suicide, by the way, when she was 18 or 16. She was a poetess born. From 4 years old, when she was four, she spoke her first verse. Yeah? She came to the window in the night and she spoke. And her grandmother, who was sleeping in the same room, wrote the verse. And the verse was very simple, childish. Alaya luna, alaya luna, red moon, red moon. Загляни в окно, look into the window. У окна стою, I stand near the window.
черная стена, black the wall, a black wall, черные углы, a black corners, черная сама, and black myself. And that was, grandmother was in tears when she was reading this, you know. When you read this, and she created so many poems afterwards, all of this kind, you know. She said, the poems are coming and they are suffocating her. They want to kill her and she has to speak them out. So she speaks them out and they come out. So she was a medium of some poetic force. And all those poets came and tried to teach her how to compose right. All those, you know, kind of guys. If you see that, that was a movie, you know, it was a comedy to see how they were arrogantly teaching her how to do. And she was such a, and when she was speaking her poetry, she was crying. She was never speaking. It was very loud and very urgent and very impossible to say. Like this. That was a poet. But if I say to myself, read to myself, it moves me so deeply. But when you read other poetry of this kind, it doesn't move you in other languages.
As I go over a little bit my question, I wanted to know, when you read now in this metaphor, you change now the sense of the word, or comes the sense of the word to this metaphor?
I think I don't change.
That is what was my first question.
Yes. No, the word.
I said now what I want to mean when I have a sentence. You can make the sentence in this meter, and you can move the sentence in another meter, and maybe you make it in a different meter, and nobody will understand. But when I have a sentence which I understand like this, and the meter comes from the sense. When you read now Sanskrit.
You answered your question, I guess. It was.
Yeah, you answered.
You answered. You said exactly what the question was, that is it really the meter is really the word finds its own identity in this meter? And I can say yes. The word finds its own identity. Yes. Actually, these meters were the ways of for the Rishi to engage all these words. They found their right place, yes? And thus we can know how to pronounce, how to really use these words in a proper sense, yes? With proper accentuation. I think so. I think meter is an inherent part of this usage for the words. And poetry is the best, the highest possible engagement with the words. Yes? Where the words finally reveal their secret meanings. They can be placed differently in a prosaic speech, yes? In a common language. But in poetry they find finally their place, their home, where they belong, because there they reveal their secret meaning, their inner meaning.
Yeah, my question is, when you read a few lines of Sanskrit in the kind of with the kind of meter that you think is right, does it enhance your understanding of the words themselves?
Yes.
You're just saying yes, or does it really?
It not only enhances, it changes the meaning of the words. Finally, you can see the meaning of the words. I will give you a few examples when you will understand the difference, yes? Because
In our speech, there are certain laws which we didn't even mention. Maybe for our philosophy of language, we should mention few of them. For example, sambodhana, what is a vocative case, yes? Vocative case, when it is opening the pada, the verse, is always stressed, yeah? On the first, when you call somebody. Or you use kam, yeah? Or if you say Vishnu, come to us. So why this Vishnu come to us? To us will be not accented, and Vishnu will be accented, and come will be accented. This is the natural way by which we speak. We never analyzed, but if we analyze them, then we will understand how it is important for the meaning in the verse. So, for example, I will say, "Come and give us wealth, Vishnu, today." Now, Vishnu will be unaccented because it is sambodhanam, vocative, within the sentence. Now, when it is within it, if I speak to you people every day, this people is vocative, which is not accented, because it's in the middle of the sentence. Here, it is all the time used by the Rishi. There are sometimes vocatives, the whole line of vocatives, which are not accented, with all the adjectives which are not accented. What does it mean? It's all in one flat. He says something and then he says all these words afterwards. I will show you a few examples which are very beautiful. For example, Dhenusha vipra amrita ritajnyah. Dhenusha vipra amrita ritajnyah. Amrita ritajnyah dvisha. Vipra amrita ritajnyah. These are all vocatives. You, or seers, immortal, knowing the truth. These are all their names which are in the vocative case, have no accent. Now, if I read with this Vedic prosodics, I will not have a clue what they are standing for. I will have to translate them to myself, to my mind. I don't feel it. Feeling comes from this manipulation with vocative cases and saying what is happening. It's a living language. All this life of language in the poetry is there. Now, how to engage with that language, with that life? One has to read it properly, accentuate it with the rhythm. And then it comes up. It comes up and you see, look, you overlooked before because you were reading with the mind. That's why you're asking, is it enhancing the meaning? It is changing it. It becomes that what it should be. And then one understands, oh, this wonderful example here to the Surya Savitri, which I will give you. Saptatva haritah rathe vahanti deva Surya. Saptatva harito rathe vahanti deva Surya. Shochishkisham vichakshana. So seven horses, they carry you, O Surya, O God, Surya. Vahanti deva Surya, they carry, O God, O Surya. Shochish kesham, the one whose kesha is shochich, flaming, flaming with hair, a hair flaming one. Vichakshana, O the one who sees all. Now, vichakshana and flaming with hair is the same Surya, but in one it is accented, that means they carry him with flaming hair. O you who sees all, vichakshana. It comes naturally by usage of this particular accentuation that you know what where it belongs in the spoken sense. Does it make sense to you? So every change, because we read English poetry, so we know already by default things which are not visible to those others who do not know this language. So when you make a presentation of pentameter, you can feel language and you know where to stop, where make a caesura, where not make caesura, where to continue, where to come to another line by default. Here we do not have default. We do not know this language. So it has to be reconstructed.
And Theater plays of Goethe and Schiller. actually not in Meta, it is fully informal. I therefore, this Meta from Shiva and Goethe is at the same what you do with that script.
The poetry you cannot avoid, the phrase, the poetic phrase, the stanza, it's a rhythmical expression of one.
I also when I speak in Meta, when I want to use theatre, but nowadays they think they must not speak English. And I feel, yeah. That is more like the Metas I brought more together with the singing of this dance.
Have you seen how have you seen how Avadhanis are doing composing poetry? Avadhanis, those poets who compose poetry on the spot. You give them the. I made a movie, Avadhanam it is called, Ashtavadhanam. Yeah, they, and they, what they do is quite interesting. They go into some kind of rhythmic trance. They have to have this. Has to get into it. Once he got it, it stays with him. Now come, ask me. He will allow words to come and to feel this rhythm. The same was a movie made by about Pushkin, who was a poet, and what he was doing, he was making. He was coming with guitar. He was making rhythm for himself, and then he was ready to compose. So now come to me. Yes, I have a rhythm within myself. The words will come to this rhythm. Did you notice when you read poetry like Shakespeare, who has very powerful rhythm inside, and you read for a while, and then you go to sleep, and you can't sleep? You know why you can't sleep? The rhythms are there. And they are bombarding your consciousness, and they demand words. And what is happening, when you are falling asleep, you are seeing how these words are coming and filling the rhythm. And poetry appears. And you want to write it down. It was so good. It was so true. Because the rhythm demands the words. It pulls them in, so to say. It's a device of consciousness.
You know, I was wondering, I was reading this last paragraph here a bit while you were speaking, and I'm wondering if there isn't a parallel in Gregorian chant. When I started learning church music, there was a way of marking certain pages, certain syllables in the Bible, so that you could. There was this initium, this was the beginning part, and then there was the straight part, and then to go down to end the verse, you always had the same melody, but you had to. Fit it to the syllables that were there, but I don't know if this has anything to do with it, because of course that was in German, and was originally maybe it wasn't even that. I don't know, can you make any connection with what you were telling us? Or is it perhaps not relevant?
Yes, of course, the rhythm. One can break with that rhythm some other verse, or one can impose it on the verse, but it is not the way how the poetry was composed. The rhythm is the meter which creates something of it's interesting. The rhythm is to be there within the language already before the words will come. Now this is the problem. You have to have a poet who would create that poetry in a true sense, then it will stay with you and will demand those words to come again. Now, if you don't have that, it's just not working that way. One can impose this rhythm on other language and see how it doesn't fit, and you know, mutilate it and fit it into it, but it is not the thing. It has to be naturally coming. The words, one by one, they're feeling that they're attracted like to the magnet. You know, they're attracted that they fit exactly into the niche of that particular rhythm, and in a particular form. And in particular meaning. And meaning is there immediately coming in. It's not meaningless, it seems. It's a very strange, mysterious device. And Shobindu speaks about these Anushtup, Trishtup, Gayatri as the rhythms of creation of the world. These were seen by the Vedic rishis as the rhythms which create the world. These are not just rhythms of the poetry. Sanskrit.
That was the original question. I mean, I see it now because you don't know how all these Vedas and these nice texts came in life. So when the Rishi or whoever makes this Sanskrit came, was there first a listen and then the word, or you made now, you have now the Sanskrit and put the listen there? That was the question what I had in the beginning.
Well, I thought I tried to answer it.
No, because you know, I have not to answer me, but this may be not answerable.
No, it is very answerable. That's what we are doing now today, trying to see that actually, it cannot be that a rhythm was imposed on some kind of statement and made poetry. Poetry has to appear together in this process when the rhythm is already established within the consciousness by the very words of the same language.
Okay, then the first text was already in this lesson.
So yes.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry that I confused you. I meant to say that... No, well, you didn't listen what I said properly, because I said that we are learning about this, because there was a poetic, so to say, science in Greece, from which we know certain things which are applicable to every poetry. It's not only to Sanskrit poetry, to every poetry.
Okay.
So...
searching way, then the words become living, but when you have the conditional repeating of the mantras, then, as you said, you have to think about what the words are meaning. In this way, you could not understand the meaning.
Yes, yeah, so, it's all okay. I want only know if this wisdom comes to you.
Yeah.
When you read Sanskrit, because you know very well Sanskrit. So the wisdom came through the Sanskrit.
Right.
That.
By the way, it took long time to find this reading, and it changed many times, and it is still not the final. What I am surprised of, because I started to read again, and I saw the beauty finally that everything matches.
Okay. That is what I want to know.
When you apply this particular vision, it matches. And it gives you a pause to breathe and to understand the word, and everything becomes natural, and it is your verse. It's not something imposed on it or artificially used.
Spoken language.
Spoken language, yes.
Now you answer my question.
I'm glad I did. So we finish today, because there is another session coming up. And maybe we will finish altogether this profound topic, because we just started to look into it. What is poetic speech, and can we at all envision such a thing that we one day we can speak in poetry? Would be that possible? I always was wondering, could we speak in poetic speech to each other?
Maybe in the beginning of creation they did.
It is such a wonder. Have you seen such movies when they speak in poetry? It is so beautiful.
Was always free. Ganapati. She discovered visions, definitely. But this was a biography which was often said that this competition with poets in verse, a competition which is traditional going on still today, this disciple, a boy, was 18 or something, young boy, and he was inspired, was a poet. And actually, he said that better knowledge comes from a special level of consciousness. It is a level of God's, it is, you can say, of mind, and that is there still today. That is the thing. It means that this young boy was receiving that. He was receiving the text in Vedic language. He was reciting them. And these were new, not old texts, which were just perceived by him. And the Gnana explained that it's true. It's not a false trick the poet he imitates. He said that if we have developed consciousness, we can reach this level. We can read, we can listen, we can see it better. It exists as a special kind of a city.
It's very true. Actually, this example was brought in our conference on Rig Veda. In this place where Ramana Maharshi, that he truly showed that he could do such amazing thing. He could bring this poetic level down in such a perfection. Everybody was surprised. It was a revelation of the Veda without any him knowing anything, composing, being a poet, anything of the kind. He was just plugging into that level and letting poetry come. That's why it is understood that the man who knows the Vedas, it is said later in Aranyakas and Brahmanas, in him all the gods reside. Because he knows the word, and by the word he makes them alive. To make them alive and to move in your consciousness, you have to express them in your consciousness. It's like something which generates or brings them to birth within your consciousness. Yes? It's a generator of that consciousness. So they enter. Later there were speculations in the medieval period, quite interesting, that Krishna says, if I hear somebody calls me Krishna, Krishna, I come. It's a speculation. Huh? If you say Krishna, Krishna, so Krishna hears the name and he comes. So this simplistic explanation of how poetry works.
Huh? But it's very difficult because it is the property of language which is evocative, it is creating, and the material level is last of creation. First was those subtle levels. So we, being on earth, we have to grow up out of earth to understand it.
Yes, yes. We are using reflective language already, which is built through evolutionary.
Yes.
It's not that original language which came. But still, it has some link to that original or depth of, in etymological sense, somewhere. And if consciousness wants to break through and to see it, it is possible. At least in Sanskrit, not to say in other languages, which are already so developed and prakritized.
Because there is also a fact, interesting, that many poets were very spiritual, very religious, very wise minded. In a sense, the mind was extraordinary, not average mind.
Yes.
Poets had a special touch, a special level.
Right. Okay, we continue next time on this, and maybe we will find something very interesting at the end. Okay, so shall we end with a minute of silence? I had suddenly a glimpse that the chandas is a device by which some higher or more powerful consciousness wants to express itself within the language. It takes this device to use the resources of language
to take them in and to express something the language cannot express. So that's why it is very natural with language, and the words are coming and filling in without any problem. So it agrees to come in, yeah, and to catch up with language. Okay?